Okay, now recording. Would you like to do the intro, Jeremy? Because I think if we work out the pattern of the way this is going to work, then we can do more like it and have a solution to introductions. We're going to talk today about game changers in overlanding and four-wheel drive, and the subject being accommodation. So we're going to talk about camper trailers and trailers and campers and caravans and rooftop tents and ground tents and sleeping inside the vehicle, everything to do with, and obviously, you know, you have a huge amount of insight yourself into rooftop. You've camped all your life and lots of rooftop tent experience. So I'd like you to be as much a part of the discussion as Paul and myself.
So, Andrew, are we going to put a timeline to this so we don't, otherwise it's going to get to a point where it gets too long and we don't wrap up? What's your thought on that?
Yes, very good point. we should time it to 30 minutes. But I think if it starts getting tired or repetitive, then Jeremy, you're free to wrap it up. You know, you be the master of ceremonies or the MC. Yes.
I think that's a good idea, because then at least it's, if you feel that a question needs to be changed, or also we need to just give a slight pause before we, so we don't cut across each other, because it is a bit of a delay on picking up stuff.
Yeah, that will be one of the things you adjust slightly, just give a little bit of breath between an answer, just because of that delay. Otherwise it won't feel as natural.
I can always make them feel natural in the edit. I can always just tighten them up. If there's a gap that's uncomfortable, I can overlap. Exactly. And I can have somebody actually speaking over somebody else if it feels like a natural interruption. So I do have some control with it in terms of the edit. Okay. So I don't think we should be too worried about it. If we do overlap a bit, I don't think that's a train smash.
Okay, great.
Excellent. So, do you want to go for it? Let me just see. Am I recording? I'm recording. Jeremy, you're going to do the intros.
Yeah, let me give it a shot. So, and I guess what we'll have to work out too is I need to think about not introducing it as time of day, because it will be irrelevant.
Well, you could actually say to people, we spanned across the entire length of the globe. That's quite interesting too.
I think so
as well. So we are here talking with Andrew White and Paul Marsh in different time zones. So good morning, good evening, and good afternoon. And we have assembled to talk about some of our favorite topics around 4X overlanding. Around overlanding happens to be 4X overlanding. And the topic I think we've discussed today is going to be accommodation. And as Andrew said before about campers and caravans and campers and camping and caravans and tents and spaces and all these kinds of things. So thank you for joining us. And I think you'll find it an interesting conversation as we talk about one of our favorite topics. Something like that.
Yeah, that's excellent. So now I came up with the idea of a series of shows about the game changing things in four drive. All of us, particularly Paul and myself, me more than the three of us, in terms of pure length of time we have spent in the bush driving vehicles and in the bush, only because I'm a little older. And we've all spent time, and I think we will all agree that it is really easy to be uncomfortable in the bush. That's really simple. So I've just taken delivery literally an hour and a half ago. So it's lunchtime here, and Paul, you're very early. You're about 7 in the morning.
Very early. The sun's rising.
The sun's just rising. And of course, Jeremy's in Seattle and sun's well down. I've just come back from collecting the camper that I'm going to be putting on the back of my extended 79 Land Cruiser. And I thought, the world has changed utterly. This camper is actually going to be wonderful. Have we all gone soft? Because it wasn't always like that. So I want to carry on.
Shall we tell Andrew to stop talking about his camper now, Paul? I think he's mentioned it 18 times and we're only a few minutes in.
I think he's really excited about this camper. Really, I think we should take the camper and put a rooftop tent on and or a ground tent. The hard stuff. Don't you agree?
I do agree.
Okay, I will shut up now about my camper. Well,
I'll
bring it in every now and again. Okay, but the point is that there has been massive changes. Mm. All of us have spent so many nights in the bush, indifferent. So I want to talk about the game changes of what used to be like, anecdotal stuff, and what it's like now, and your take on the developments in rooftop tent design, for example, and camper design. And would you tow an off-road caravan? I wouldn't. Would you? So I thought that would be make a nice subject for some discussion.
So it is interesting to see how it has changed. And I guess I've experienced it in a way where rooftop tents were a big game changer. My early days were spent in the bush in ground tents, working for safari companies and, you know, living out of ground tents, which most people have experienced. And I think you should. But roof tents for me, when I moved to England, I took the agency with me of a roof tent and put a roof tent on a vehicle at a four-wheel drive show. And I think myself, a friend and his dog slept in it that night. So don't even ask, don't even begin to imagine. But when the three of us put our heads out the door in the morning, we had a whole crowd around the vehicle. I'm not kidding. There must have been 20 people waiting for us to wake up so they could actually see this roof tent in England. And this is right back in the early 90s. So it was fascinating to see how that changed in many ways. Overland travel.
So I should add here that in England, a lot of the expos are outside. If you park on a green meadow, it will rain, and the participants, the people actually showing their wares and selling stuff, very often camp at the event. So that was that was one of the early easy-on traditional rooftop tents that fold out like this. Not so.
Yeah, exactly. It was, it was still the Easy On were one of the pioneers of rooftop tents, I would say, in the world. I mean, there were other models around, but certainly in Africa, they led the way totally. And a lot of other manufacturers followed on to build comparable products. And I think that that really gave people sort of something where they could look at this in a different light. So it wasn't off-roading. It wasn't green laning, because in England, the two elements of four-wheel drive were mostly off-roading and green laning, and a very small percentage of overland travel. And of course, as I think we know, Europe tends to live in the vehicles that they build for four-wheel drive travel more than out. Mm-hmm. In Africa, you tend to live outside the vehicle and around the vehicle more than in it.
Mm-hmm. Paul, can you explain green laning? That's not a term that the US folks can understand.
Green laning is really where you've got permission in England to take your four-wheel drives on old closed tracks. Maybe they're railway lines, maybe they are paths that go to different areas. And it's not really a commonly used public road as per se, but it's more off-road. They can get a bit muddy, they can get a bit boggy, but it's taking you across the countryside in a sense. Mm. And of course, off-roading is a lot in England, which is quite a big sport really. And I think many parts of the world where the guys build these big challenge vehicles. And the hardest part for me in those early days was actually trying to educate people the difference between overlanding and the difference in how you would camp around and out of a vehicle. And of course, the roof tent had a different take on this whole process and how it went forward.
So it's interesting. I mean, I think we've talked about this, I think, around campfire a bit, where the U.S. has been behind. I don't know if it's odd, but it's been behind in adopting a lot of the things that folks have been doing for a long time. Other places, Africa's, really because of distance and the necessity and the lack of things in between. I don't know the year I started seeing rooftop tents, because growing up it was all caravans, and even before that it was cab over campers in the back of a full-size truck. So it was the insert canopies, the big ones, the very heavy ones, the top heavy ones, not the nice ones like four-wheel campers, not those, not even the Palominos. It was before that. So that was the way you basically camped. And then of course you had pole tents and or big family cabin tents, and that was, that really was camping. It was not even as common to have a a caravan. We call them trailers in the US. To have a trailer, that was for the people that could afford a trailer. Everybody else was a tent, and it was these slide-in things in the back of a truck. So when we started seeing, I think, rooftop tents and the versions of those, it was exotic. It was, this person must be on an expedition. This person had some money. We don't know how much, because it was just completely new ground for me. I remember as a young man, but also, where must they be going that they need this this thing on top of their car that, you know, it's going to stay out of the water? Are they going underwater? Are they, you know, I mean, it's all these kind of things. And I don't remember thinking, well, they're going to be safer up there. I just remember thinking, that's interesting. It's on top of their car, as opposed to the big bag that, as a family, all seven of us slept in as, you know, kids.
Safety was actually a really interesting concept. And Andrew, I think you'll agree to this, is that became a big thing for roof tents. You're going to be safer, really, because of the wild animals.
Yeah.
So people got the feeling that if you're going to go out traveling in the bush, and I think, Andrew, you'll find as well, as time has gone on, it's become more accessible to go traveling to more remote wild places for the average person. Mm-hmm. And one of the big questions, I think, for everyone was around safety. How safe is it? You know, and I guess that's where, you know, living in a caravan, like Jeremy, you guys grew up. Safety was probably not such an element there, because it was more convenience. But certainly in Africa, when you're traveling on long overland trips, putting up a tent on the ground day in, day out tends to be seen as a more cumbersome way of doing it. And there's advantages and disadvantages to both. What do you think?
No, it's a good question. Andrew and I have talked about this, about, you know, Andrew, you did a video on comparing rooftop tents, I think, 2-3 years ago, something like that. A really good video on why you might want one and why you might want to set them up, and you compared a number of different things. We've talked about the safety thing quite a bit. I mean, is that something you think is that, does that make your top three list of reasons why you want a rooftop tent?
Initially, I think the very obvious advantage were three things. You could protect yourself against animals to a degree, and you had a supposedly quick setup and pack up time, which is questionable as we know now. And the convenience of, if you had a smallish vehicle like a station wagon or something like that, a place to leave your mattresses and sleeping bags and pillows, which take up a lot of space. And that was those are the three big advantages. But the question is that it seems to me that as that product, that rooftop tent, has moved to different parts of the world, in Australia, why would we need protection from wild animals? We don't, do we? Maybe crocodiles. There are moments where you would prefer to be elevated if you were camped on some river bank up Queensland or whatever, Northern Territory. But it wasn't a big deal. And it seemed to me that convenience was the big deal, but also the mental attitude that I'm self-contained. Look at me. I've got everything in one, almost like a psychological difference when driving a vehicle with a house on top. You know what I'm saying? And yeah, almost it was that. Maybe that's what convenience, the biggest appeal.
Yeah. Andrew, you're absolutely right. I think convenience is definitely a factor. And I think the shell type, clamshell tents, which hinge at the front or they pop up straight up, have given convenience a new name, because to open and close those are far quicker than anything else, even a ground tent. And you've got the convenience of, as you said, not having your bedding, which is bulky, in the car. So from that perspective, it's absolutely great. What I have seen, though, I've seen a lot of clients over the 30 years I've been building vehicles that have progressed through the use of the different products. So they started off using, when they were a lot younger, the flip out tent, because it gave them a little bit more roof rack space, and they were going on a trip maybe with a difference, to a point when they decided actually they could afford a more expensive tent, and they went for the clamshell type, to eventually progressing through to the point where they're actually now getting older and going, we don't actually want to clamber up onto the roof. We'd like the containability inside a vehicle. And I definitely have seen this over the years, that there's different sectors of people who quite honestly like different comforts, right down leading on to the caravans and the trailers. And I think the trailers maybe have a different niche market. But for the people going overland, it's definitely been a progress of, you know, getting to a point where I've sometimes built a third vehicle for a client, and it's been a live-in as opposed to a live out of. It's more, you can live out of if you're in Africa because the environment allows it. But if you're driving across South America or other parts of really remote, cold places, live-in is definitely preferable.
I want to come back to the safety thing for a second, a different perspective. And this is something that, you know, I think as I've been asked, and I've thought about, just this last week, I was telling a group of people's story about traveling in Africa, and they wanted to kind of know the whole story and who these people were. And this, it's such a different thing. I mean, the animals obviously make it amazing, and the birds and the life and the rivers and everything about it is just, it's absolutely spectacular. When I tell, and they love the stories and the pictures, when I tell somebody we camped in Africa, they don't even let me get to the next piece of that sentence. Oh my God, did you, I kid you not, 5 out of 10 times somebody says, did you have a gun? That's the first response. And then Australia, not unlike the same thing, everything on the news and everything on National Geographic and everything says, except for the Australia tourist guides, says Australia wants to kill you. Everything there wants to eat you. And we all know that's ridiculous. But there's more snakes of types. There's big things that crawl. And I have to say, there's a lot of credence to people not wanting to sleep in a ground tent that has things rubbing up against it, or things crawling that you see in the shadow as you shine your light out and you see a creepy crawly going over the top. You guys come from a place where you have been in the bush, really in the bush. I think the real bush, Africa, Australia, Outback, whatever. U.S. is, you can absolutely get remote. I'm not going to say it's always posh, it's always contained. It's not. There's a lot of great wild territory, big critters, big animals. It really can. It is real outdoors. But I think if you count on your hands the things that perception of people, count on your hands the things that will eat you, kill you, want you, take your stuff, and it's dangerous to be around, people have a very short list in the U.S. I mean, there are things, but mostly it's going to be bears because they're attracted to food, and all the other kind of critters and varmints and things they're not as concerned about. But anybody says Africa or Australia, they're mortified that someone would camp ever there. That's actually the number one question I get. So safety, I have more conversations about that by a landslide than what kind of tent, or was it aluminum or fiberglass, or how fast did you get out of it, or how fast did it take to, you know, from zero to beer. People don't even think about that. The first thing they think of is, you didn't die, I can't believe it.
But I think, you know, you're right. I mean, it's where you haven't been, it's what you don't know that you don't know, is an adage that I use often. And I think, you know, people coming to Africa, or Australia for that matter of fact, have gone to those areas and gone, oh my God, it's actually not what I expected. I mean, you can go into the bush, you're not going to be eaten alive. You do, however, have to be responsible.
Yeah,
and I have a stand that I take about responsible overlanding, and I believe that that's a lot of what people need to actually do and endorse. And it's about taking that responsibility, understanding that if you're going to go into the wildlife areas of Australia or Africa or anywhere really, that you understand what you're up against. What are the animals? What are the risks? And then how do you choose to mitigate that risk? For some people, it's a caravan because it's going to be more of what they, that's their risk factor. And they will curtail their trip around lugging a caravan or a trailer. Wouldn't you think, Andrew? I mean, you've seen South Africa in that sense in many ways, and Australia for sure.
Yes, and people will, you're absolutely that, they will adapt their living quarters according to the risks they're willing to take. Absolutely correct.
Yeah.
So it has been an interesting, it's been an interesting growth phenomenon, you know, and I look at people who come to me and they say, I would like to take a trail and drive through Africa. You can do it. You can make it happen. Is it maybe the best solution? Well, I would say it's going to be a more challenging solution. It does depend on how people want to live. If they're taking a family, that some of them don't see themselves in a vehicle that has that sort of capacity, unless it's a big truck. And that in itself is not only very expensive, but it's also, you know, has its other challenges when you're going for a very big vehicle. You know, in the States, I've traveled across there a few times, and I must say I've been amazed to see these huge, big RVs, massive. And they're incredible. And I bumped into a couple, and they were just so delightful. They had this parked up, the most spectacular view you can imagine. They were sitting out there, and I walked up to have a chat to them, and I said, you know, what's your story? And they said, we sold everything we had and we bought this RV to go and travel. And we have a mobile home now that we absolutely enjoy and we travel with. And they said, we don't have a garden. Look at our garden. Just take a look at this view. You know, and the other thing is they engage with people all the time. So it's absolutely fantastic that.
They call that the RV life or RVing here. And then I think in Australia, I love the term in Australia. Best one I've ever heard is the Grey Nomads.
Grey Nomads, yeah, brilliant.
I love that. Brilliant, brilliant name.
And why not? Why not? You know, do you think, Jeremy, that Andrew's going to head that way? Is he going to sell up everything, move into his camper van with Gwen? And, you know, Andrew, I think you want to come in here, man.
Well, if there was that spot on the Indian Ocean, it was a spot on the Indian Ocean we woke up to with the stingrays that morning, I could... As long as there was nobody else there, I could definitely do that for an extended period of time. When we were in Australia, Paul, we were coming back down the coast from Broome, and we had had a pretty massive trip of a lot of dusty days, as you know, and we were coming down looking for something that kind of would break us out of this dust and kind of, you know, just sage and things. And we came in kind of late at night to this bay. It's a park. I don't know. It's a state park. It's a managed park. You pay a fee to get in, and but it's you know, open camping, and there's Grey Nomads all staying down there. Really nice place. I don't think we understood how amazing it was until we woke up in the morning.
The thing is, there's an estimate, and I can't remember where I saw it, but over 100,000. Of these people, of these Grey Nomads, are touring Australia and driving around Australia at any one time, 100,000. And you see them when you're on the road, and you can be in the middle of nowhere. And I've seen them on some of the extremely remote, not so much the tracks, because they're mostly pulling caravans that are not suitable. Suitable for gravel roads, yes, but certainly not suitable for desert tracks, like crossing the Simpson or anything like that. But they are remote, and there are lots of plenty of them. So. Yeah.
But then again, you know, as you say, with going back to choosing what you're going to use, you know, I think a lot of people have been burnt and learned some very hard lessons. I certainly did in the early days of choosing something that was actually not suitable for what I was going to do. You know, like choosing a caravan or a trailer or a roof tent or something where it's not really fit for the purpose you're going to use it for. You bought it maybe because it was cheap or because the salesman was really a good salesman. And that's where I implore with people to actually go and really understand what is their need, what is the equipment that's going to best serve them in that need, so that they can actually spend their money knowing that if they choose a caravan, it's actually going to serve them in the places they're going to. Because every product can work in different scenarios. Mm-hmm. The worst thing is to have the wrong product for a scenario where you're towing it across hectic roads and it's falling apart behind you. You know, and that's the sad part, because it destroys every dream that someone's going to enjoy on their trip.
The other part about that is, and you make a very good point, is that how do you know when you're in a showroom and you've got this, say, for example, a trailer or a camper trailer. So you've got a trailer having to pull down the vehicle, and it's got to be robust, as you say, to stay in one piece on rough tracks. How rough are the tracks are you going to take? Is it going to be good enough? It's difficult to measure. And also, when you go into a showroom, and it's all beautiful. And there's the thing with a beautiful tent and a little veranda, little shade thing, and there's your barbecue, and it's wonderful. But then I've heard of so many people, not that many, but enough to talk about buying a camper trailer and using it once and saying never again, purely because the amount of time it took them to set it up and the amount of time it took them to pack it away was so onerous that it just wasn't suitable for them. How do you know that when you're in the showroom actually looking at these wonderful products? Do you actually disassemble it in the show? Ask the guy, can I please pack this away and re-erect it in your showroom so I can understand what difficult one?
But no, but you're absolutely right. I think that's the challenge. You know, products are sold exactly in that scenario. And I wouldn't blame so much that the salesperson maybe needs to take the person and meet their expectations. Because, you know, we all have an expectation when we buy something of how it's going to work. We have this perception in our mind. We bought this product. We've imagined how it's going to work with not really knowing how it's going to work. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's something to learn for the guy who gets that back and says, you know what, let me show you how this product works. I used to open and close enough roof tents until they'd be silly. And I'd make the people open them and close them enough times so that they got to feel what it was like to close that tent up and climb in. And if they wanted to have a snooze for half an hour, I'm happy to let them do that. It was that important just to get a feel for what is it like in this space. I mean, a roof tent, for example, is quite a small space. There's two of you in the roof tent. So is this the right size? Is it easy enough to open and close? And your point about the trailer is exactly right. And I think it's sad that someone's dream got diminished in that way because maybe they didn't understand what they were getting into. Maybe they didn't actually have the full understanding of what it takes to open and close this. Because if they did, they wouldn't have been let down.
So it opens up an interesting exercise. And we talked a little bit when we've traveled together, I think, about this. We talked about this concept of requirements. And requirements is a consulting concept that if you identify the requirements of what you have, and yet we use this with our families, we use it with people we talk to, we use it in our businesses. If you outline the set of requirements, then it begins to define what your needs are. The tricky thing, though, is that many people, to your point, both of you have said, if you know this or if you know that, if someone goes into a showroom and says, I'm going to take the Gibb River Road. Have you ever been on the Gibb River Road? Nope, but I need a caravan that'll do it. That's an interesting conversation to have because it's going to vibrate everything to pieces. If it's a wood frame caravan, that has hanging beads and little curtains and shelves and things on the inside of it. And it looks like a small house made for somebody that wants a small house. It will shake itself to pieces, but it's not, like you said, it's not the sales guy's fault. It's just that they weren't really aware of the requirements. But I think one of the number one requirements of people buying this, specifically caravans, actually I own a caravan, so I have a pretty good idea. But what's interesting is, I didn't buy it new. I bought it used, well used, and it's very inexpensive. So I didn't spend a lot of money on it. But the interesting thing is this. I have other ways to camp. I have other ways to wake. Andrew said something amazing, and I'm sure, Paul, you agree with this. I don't necessarily like camping. I will never forget this. I just like waking up in beautiful places.
And I think a lot of people would agree there and say that's true.
That's what they want, is the living room to be the caravan's front door. So when you walk out, you're on a beautiful vista and you're looking at this amazing, you know, this wildlife and the birds in the morning. It's a favorite thing to do. But I can do that with a rooftop tent. I can do that with the bed of my truck. I can do that with a ground tent. I can do it with a bivouac. I can do it with 75 other things. One of the biggest requirements is my wife won't come with me if I don't have something that has a bathroom in it. If it doesn't have something that they feel safe. So I'm going back to safety. So is it that a lot of these people are buying? Now, it's true. A lot of them don't feel safe otherwise, because a caravan and what we're talking about, overlanding, are not necessarily synonymous. Caravanning, for most people, I think, they're looking for a park with hookups. So their TV works in the evening. And I don't think it's wrong. That is very, like you talked about the RVers with the great big Class A diesel pusher, massive motorhomes, they call motorhomes. I think that's fantastic that people want to live that lifestyle. Caravanning is somewhere along those lines where what feels safe to them is they want to go to the lake and stay for 4 days and plug in. It's not, if we were to define overlanding, and maybe this is a question, a great question for discussion, is a caravan accommodation actually for overlanding, or is it a way to have a home away from home, you know, from point A to point B, or is there versions? I know there's products and versions in between, but is it really overlanding if you've got a true and proper kind of caravan-y thing you're towing behind you, or does it have to be on a vehicle, smaller, only one axle? What goes from caravanning down to overlanding, and what makes the threshold for you guys?
So I'd like to make a point, because I had a lot of experience with, well, your very good valid point is the husband wants to do this, and the only way he can get it to happen is his wife, to get his wife to buy in, is to basically have a set of scenarios. Okay, and go, it has to have this. And I think I found over the years that quite often the husband and wife are not always on the same page. And I work quite hard with the couple, and I always do all my consulting and training and preparation with the couple together. Because quite often there are some misunderstandings, or maybe there are some fears or concerns. And I found if I've addressed those fears and concerns, and I remember clearly, you know, one couple, the wife was adamant, she was ready. It was literally, she just didn't want to do this. And it was sad because you could see they had a passion to go outdoors, but this going and camping was the big block. And actually what it really amounted down to, she didn't really know how to go to the loo in the bush. Mm, yeah. And that was her big showstoppers, because the panic set in is like, I don't think I can do this. You know, to go into loo, use a loo in the bush and squat and do this, how's this going to be? Now, when we unpacked that, that disappeared. That concern disappeared. Yeah. They actually traveled for years together, loving it. And I think, you know, a bucket became something they could use if they needed to. And it's sort of, what I'm really saying is that, you know, it is understanding what people's needs are. And a caravan does have a place. And you're going to get the person who says, I'm going to take my caravan through Africa. Okay. And to your point, is it the most ideal thing? Well, probably not, but it doesn't mean to say it can't be done. Would a trailer work? It can work. Is it the most ideal? Probably not. There are certain reasons why you might say it will or won't work. It's very hard to actually define what is an absolute has to. It's more about guidance around experience. And I think to your point, when you're going to go and choose something, the more people you can actually engage with who've got first-hand experience of either traveling, you know, with a caravan, and then identifying what the pitfalls are, you'll come away and make your decision better prepared. And I think often people run into making decisions too quickly and stepping back and going, let me understand the full picture. Let me understand what are the ramifications of going on an overland expedition. Because it's a dream that we all have. I mean, the dream, Andrew's just built this amazing truck. That's a dream for people. That's what we're working with, people's dreams. And it's how they can, and I never want to take away someone's dream. If he can only go into the bush with a cheap tent and a foam mattress, he must do that, or she must do that, because that's their dream. It doesn't make it right or wrong. It's just what actually would maybe work better, or what, how could you make a better decision if you were more, you had better understanding of what your needs were.
Mm-hmm.
I love your take on that. It's understanding, you know, understanding person's needs. What's your thoughts, Andrew?
The couple thing is a big deal, because they will never really think exactly the same, particularly at the beginning. And then once they've done a couple of trips together, then their ideas will start to mesh, hopefully. Otherwise they just won't do it again, or they'll adapt to each other, and then they will say, okay, where is my most flexible, least flexible, which is one of Jeremy's training thing. So having a toilet inside, somebody might say, I'm not willing to negotiate on that. I'm not right. going to go and squat behind a bush no matter where. Fine, that becomes a non-negotiable. So it's not flexible. It's at the top of the list. And I think making this list is really a good idea. Now, both people and couples should actually both make a list. Say, what's flexible? What's least flexible? They will not be the same. Then when they're put together, then you've got one list. And if they're at the top, they're at the top together, not one necessarily above the other. They're not flexible. And therefore, take that list and say, okay, now how are we going to travel? Okay, we have to have a caravan because it has to satisfy our least flexible. And therefore, because we're towing and because it might be a big object like a caravan, for example, well, in that case, we can't do the canning stock route, for example. So we then have to adapt our routes and traveling according to our equipment and decisions.
And I think that's a good, very valid point. Putting the lists together and putting the blending, the ideas together, it's again, when you sit down with a couple who've never done this before, the idea of how you could do it differently. So a good idea is like a shower. You know, there's lots of ways of taking a shower in the bush. We can have a lovely shower like you have on your vehicle there. It's a nice and hot shower. The smile on your face when you're having a shower is priceless, okay? And for a lot of people, they go, well, you know, a shower would be really nice. How can I do this? This is a non-negotiable, okay? Mm-hmm. Well, the budget might not allow for the really expensive shower, but it doesn't mean to say it couldn't be done in a different way to still attain that. And I think that's, and also it's a lot about what people haven't experienced yet. So sometimes I've said to people, why don't you go and hire a vehicle and actually do some training beforehand so that when you hire the vehicle, you know what to expect. You already go prepared. Because that's my big bugbear when people take vehicles out, you can crush a good experience because you didn't actually have enough knowledge to take you on the basics to get through that. And that allows you to actually get a feel for what it's like to travel. And you might then come to your own decision that what you thought you needed isn't really what you want.
So that's a great point. I think what you think you need many times, and this is human of us, what we think we need is what somebody else has. So if you drive down your road to your home and you see somebody with a new caravan, then all of a sudden you have this interest in saying, well, maybe I want to go take a look at this thing. And maybe you don't. But I'll tell you, the rooftop tent thing, when you see a Prado, or where I'm at, if we see a 4Runner or a Tacoma or a Tundra, those all happen to be Toyotas, or you see a Jeep, or Jeep is the most accessorized thing in the U.S., hands down. They have rooftop tents. In fact, now you can get a Mini Cooper Clubman. You can get a Yaris. You can get the smallest vehicle you can think of that's running around with these massive box folded up tents that are the size of the car, but the most unaerodynamic thing in the world. But everyone sees them and says, I think that's people going camping. I'm supposed to do that. That's the new way to camp. And so all of a sudden, we have a generation now that expects if you're going camping, there's a huge tent thing on top of your car, and that's how you must travel. And I think that's what's expected now is what you see when you drive through a neighborhood. And it's becoming very common, especially with younger folks, that and when the economy's good and people can afford things, and I won't get off on my kick about people's parents buying them everything they want, but that's now, that's the norm. There's a particular brand, there's a couple of brands in the U.S. where the tents, not unlike the Ezion, are these kind of, they fold up, but they don't fold up into something portable. They fold up into something the size of the entire top of the car, and they're massive. And I'm thinking to myself, now we have a whole different set of requirements on how much fuel does it take to get to where we're going, because the drag must be terrible on this vehicle, and does it have enough power to get up the hill? So it's almost comical, but that's becoming the norm, I think, because of what other people see. So what is realistic to go camping, and what do you absolutely need? You said it's based on requirements. I'm finding that accommodations, my want and comfort are what I would like to go do is changing. I'm not interested really in taking a caravan overlanding really at all. There is a place for a caravan that I like, but I agree. I kind of like climbing inside a vehicle now and having everything done and getting up in the morning and kind of having everything done where it just kind of closes back up. If that were the requirement, there's a lot of ways, to your point, you could do that.
Jeremy, you've actually, I think the norm, as you put it, so I saw that in England. So England, in a sense, didn't really have overlanding expedition as a big thing. And I think what drove it a lot in England was the roof tent, if I have to be honest. I think, you know, the roof tent market, I imported roof tents for years, and a lot of other companies did into England and to Europe and that. So the roof tent became synonymous with, I'm going on an expedition. So when you saw someone with that on their vehicle, automatically there was this, oh my God, they've got a dream, they're going to go and travel. I want to be a part of that. I actually want to feel that I can also do that. So again, what we're really talking about here is people having dreams. And I think the big thing about having a dream, which we should all have, we should all hold on to a dream, because it's hope, and hope is very precious in our lives. I think when you've got a dream of doing something and you've got something that is synonymous with that, it's a very clear statement when you put something like a roof tent onto your vehicle, or you've got something. It's, hey, I'm organized, I'm going overland, I'm going on an expedition. And if we look at something similar, the GS1200 motorbike, BMW, how did that become one of the most sought after motorbikes to go across the world on travel expedition? Because two
long,
guys...
Long way around, yeah. Long way around.
So Jeremy, what those guys...
Jeremy,
I tell you what. I do, because of that show.
There we go. So what inspired you to go and buy a 1200 BM was the fact that you could become a part of what these guys did. And I think that's a lot of what we are sharing and talking about today, is we are actually here to teach and educate with our experience. And there are a lot of amazing people in our industry who do that and share their knowledge and experience. And I think that's fantastic, because what we want is we want to actually empower people to go and achieve their dreams in the right way, so that they can go and enjoy it. Now, how they're going to do that is to be able to choose the right piece of equipment. It might be a trailer, because their needs and their parameters for doing that. And as long as they can make that decision with clear understanding of what the limitations of the product are, clear understanding of how well it's made, and also to understand their budget, and do they need that or do they want it, and what's going to actually work for them. It's the old adage, take less gear and more knowledge, I think is a very valuable thing I'm often saying to clients.
Do you think
yours is so empty, or your double cab, you've got nothing in the back yet? Trust me, he's going to fill it.
Yeah, but to answer the question, you think that the very fact that you had this big thing on top of a vehicle actually created almost like a new industry, both in the US and in England. Suddenly there are the vehicles driving around with tents on the top, and people were kind of saying, that looks interesting, what is that? Do you think that was instrumental in the change?
Well, Europe always had a long history of overlanding. I mean, I think for years and years, since I was 10, I wanted to drive through Africa, and I used to see vehicles quite often from Germany or Holland coming down, and you know, people would live in their cars and they would drive them through Africa and they'd make it. And of course, long before that, people have traveled on expeditions well before our time and made it happen. I think what's made it easier is there's a combination of things. Equipment has become more accessible, more affordable. People have been able to go and access areas more safely. I mean, today, and we'll talk about this sometime, you know, how it's changed with communications and how it's changed with that level of being safer, going further and more remote. So people are extending their own comfort zones to go on what's perceived as, I need to go and do this expedition. How am I going to do it? And what has driven it, I think, is a lot of people wanting to be a part of something. You know, how many people have talked about, I'd love to go and do an overland expedition trip, because it's something that not many people do. It's a very small percentage of people actually who go and travel on overland. In some countries like Australia and South Africa, it's more inherent for the local population. Most people we know have done it. they've been traveling. It's not a big thing, you know. You'll go and camp with a trailer or a caravan or a tent.
So my question there is, so if that's the case, then are people, when they look at that and they say, okay, I'd like to do what those people are doing, it looks interesting, it sounds interesting, and the first stop is to a tent shop, because they are thinking first their accommodation before anything else. Because you and I have been, all of us, we've been traveling for so many years using a very ordinary ground tent where our accommodation actually wasn't our primary concern. Our primary concern was probably tires, because we were going on a place where we knew that the vehicle would take a hammering and that our tires would be ripped to pieces if we didn't look. That was our priority. Whereas people coming in, they're seeing, driving past down the highway, the car with a tent on top and saying, oh, I need one of those. I need to do what they're doing. Therefore, I need that. And the only thing that they're actually seeing is that great big tent on the roof. And that's like a default. Oh, I'll go and buy a great big tent on the top. And then not going too much further, when actually I don't think the accommodation is necessarily the priority. I don't know. Is it? What do you think?
I don't think it's the tent. I think the tent has the biggest visual impact. You know, it's very hard for someone to understand when you see a vehicle that's all prepared and you look at a Land Rover that's got all kit on it and you look at a plain one or you look at a Toyota, either one, you know, but synonymous with them is the unprepared vehicle. It's very difficult to tell what the person's doing with that. Now, you could have someone who puts the tent and everything inside, and then you could have the other person who's got his roof tent on the vehicle. You wouldn't then really take too much note of the tires and all the work that's gone to preparing the vehicle at that point. When you stood back and looked at it, the one that would probably talk, would certainly to me, that I'm going to go on expedition, is the one that's got the roof tent on, it's got the max tracks, it's got, that's talking to me. It doesn't take away that there's a lot more to prepare and a lot more, and probably definitely not the first thing you put on your list. But it's talking to me as a concept of, I would like to embark on that. And this is the great challenge, is how? I think that's the big question people come to.
Go ahead, Andrew.
Jeremy, how does one actually go about that, answering that questions in the right order?
Yeah, so let me comment on that, because I know we've talked about this a lot, and I've thought about this a lot. When you see a tent, I think one of the things you said is right on. It's a dream. I'd love to go do that. I wonder where they're going. It's going to be fun. Or if you want to be outdoors, this is a great way to do that. I need to learn whatever they're doing. I need to learn it. The thing, though, is when you see a vehicle with all that stuff on it, I feel like when I first started seeing those as a younger man, it was almost instruction 101 on how to go do it. So, okay, it looks like if I take a close look, I need a tent. And there's one on the roof. I can't afford that, but okay, I'm going to need something. I'm going to need tires that are bigger than the ones I have now. I'm going to need lots of stickers on the back to show that I've been somewhere. I'm going to need a spare. I'm going to need a trash can. I'm going to need all these things. When people go to Overnight Expo, for example, like in Flagstaff or even on the East Coast, I think a lot of people are going to school. It's like going to uni for overlanding to figure out what it is to do. One of the biggest barriers, I think, and I'd like to get your thoughts on this, because I know we've talked about it before, is people see the show, people see Forks Overland and want to go do it. The challenge is they don't know how to. It's not that it's hard to open a tent and close a tent, because you can be trained and you can watch YouTube, and YouTube's the great equalizer, right? It can teach you all kinds of things. Did you guys get it right the first time? and how many years did it take you to figure out how to go do it? Because you had a dream, you started, and you all have videos that go way back, and I know you didn't get it right the first time. But that's the thing, I think, is getting people, you know, Andrew, your tagline on the posters that we did for the shows and things is expedition inspiration. And Paul, you've just said it. We really want people to be motivated to go do. We want to teach. We want to share. How did you figure out how to go do it?
We just did it.
You know, it's an interesting, you make those mistakes, hey, Andrew? I mean, you make the mistakes of going.
Oh, absolutely, all the time. Oh, that fell off. Okay.
And even today.
And then happens today. Enough times, eventually you say, I won't do that anymore. <You know>?
So you don't have to be perfect. You don't have to know everything. You don't have to watch. YouTube is great. But part of this whole thing, and that's kind of the point, is expect that it's not going to go perfectly. The weather's going to change. I mean, there's a myriad. There is a myriad of things that can go wrong, and they will do. You all the things that you never thought about, and then there's, you know, some people overcomplicate it by taking a spare of everything. The Africa Build series, Paul, that you did so much narration on, was a masterclass in what things should you think about taking that you might need, and what things do you just not need to take because it's kind of ridiculous. And then, okay, you might not need them, but if you're in Africa on sand track for 600Ks, you might want to think about it. All those kinds of things, I think, probably gave more people peace of mind. And I think, Andrew, that's one of the best received series you've done in years, in that it was a masterclass on, I think, giving people confidence, maybe for the first time, to take a vehicle and go out of the house, and it's okay, because Paul taught us and Andrew taught us that not only do we not have to have the best brand new Rover in the world, and it doesn't have to have 6 cameras and, you know, electronic suspension, which none of which it should do, we now have the confidence and an older vehicle could be done. We don't have to do everything we did there. That's one of the biggest barriers, is that people don't know where to start, and they think they have to have a huge tent on top to even leave the house and go out. And that's, I think we'd all agree, it's not true.
It's a very good point there, exactly where do people start? And like you say, you know, where did we start? And we can go back and recount the starting and how we started. At that time, you know, there weren't a lot of products around. It was a very unexplored market. The people who did it out of sheer passion and had a lot more challenges, you know. And we'll talk about things like traveling without GPS and without cell phones and without, you know, a lot of comforts and luxuries.
So maybe I can give you a little anecdote of my very first trip that I did on my own. Not with my dad, this was my own. I got my Range Rover, and now it was, ooh, like this. I put some sound insulation in because you couldn't hear yourself think in the car in Top Gear, and I was ready to go. And that's all I did. And 4 people in the car, with some food and a cool box and some, you know, and we went down to on the Natal coast, Cozy Bay, and we hit sand, and I got bogged down in a hollow. I couldn't get out. I couldn't go back and couldn't get out. I couldn't go back and couldn't get out. I just couldn't get out. I just couldn't get out. Now, the one and only book that I had read on the subject was by Jack Jackson, and he was using mostly old series Land Rovers in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Asia, things like this. And not a mention of tire pressures, not one mention in the entire book on tire pressures. And I can only assume that they didn't really do too much changing of tire pressures, because they were using cross-ply tires and they were tubed. So tube tires, you let pressures down on tube tires, they overheat incredibly quickly. So maybe it just wasn't something that they were doing. They were just coping with hard tires. But anyway, nothing about tire pressures. And if I had known about tire pressures on that first trip, I wouldn't have had the slightest difficulty driving in that train. Not the slight, it would have just arrived. We would have just arrived. But instead, we spent a day trying to get over these sandy, you know, first time. So when I got back and started reading more, I thought, I wish somebody had written something about tire pressures. It was one of the reasons why I eventually wrote a book. Not that I was the first person in the world to write a four-wheel drive book, but in that country I was. And it was, actually, tire pressures are really important. But we didn't know. We didn't die. I eventually got out, actually in reverse, interestingly enough. Managed to get out in reverse and then tonked it from the way down to get through. But, you know, that's what we did. And I look back on that and I smile to myself and said, we knew nothing. And yet we had a ball. We made it to the beach. We camped on the beach. It was brilliant.
So to the point, I think you're right. I mean, you know, I've come across people in Africa, and we came across a couple. Oh, it was on our trip up through Africa for 1.5 years. And they were stuck, and I'd helped the guy fix his car. And I headed off, and I had something puzzled me. His wife didn't respond at all. And I said to my ex-wife, I said to her, she's a doctor, and I said, I'm puzzled. There's something not right. We need to go back. You know, when you travel, you become more connected with yourself. You really do. And you pick up on things. And I certainly did. And this just didn't stack up. And we drove back to them and they'd moved on. The car wasn't the problem. She had full-blown malaria. And actually, it wasn't malaria. It was viral encephalitis. Anyway, we looked after her. We got her onto a drip and very dehydrated. And I said to him, I said, you're going from here to the airport. You're going to get evacuation. And they did exactly that, and we helped them through that. And I think months later, we caught up with them. They come back on their trip in a campsite. And they came up to me and they said, we owe you a debt of gratitude, because had we not done exactly that at that time, his wife wouldn't have survived. You know, to get out, she was in really a bad state. And, you know, it just goes to show that you can get away with an awful lot when you travel, but you run massive risks. And I think in these days of when there is information and there is knowledge and there are people who are willing to share that, why take that risk? Because it's not you that you risk. You risk other people. And it's in a group when one person comes with a car that's really not prepared properly. He's the weak link in the chain. Everyone else carries that risk. And that's where I think when people are traveling in groups, I do a lot of discussion around roles and responsibilities. And what is your responsibility to the group? And what is your role in the group? So that you can be very clear that you're not that weak link. And it is a balance. And I think that balance comes with knowledge, and it comes with education, and it comes with some experience, and it comes with some making some mistakes, because we're all still learning. But it's good to get to a level point where you feel you've actually got a good starting point that's going to give you a good level or measure of success. And that's where, how much risk are you prepared to take? Mm-hmm. And I think ignorance, when many couples I come across, ignorance is probably the worst thing. People come unstuck and big problems. And when you reverse the situation and see what caused that problem, you realize that it was not only ignorance, it was a lot of, they didn't discipline, they didn't have the right equipment, they took a lot of risks. And that's something we can mitigate. And that's
I think, you know, we're coming up to the hour now. So, but I'm listening to you guys and I'm thinking to myself, we should, because we're going to try and do this regularly, these presentations. I think the next one should be about risk. I think we should have an honest talk about risk. Because, I mean, you're the same. When you build a vehicle for your client, Paul, what you're doing is you're removing one of the risks. The risk is that somebody builds a vehicle and doesn't really understand the requirements, or doesn't even understand their own requirements until they're asked the right questions. And you ask the right questions, and then you remove that part of the risk by building a truck that removes so much of the risk. Then your training removes a whole lot more of the risk. So I think that we should have a discussion on what are the risks, and what are the risks that we're prepared to take and not prepared to take. And again, it's the flexible, most flexible, least flexible concept. And we should actually talk about the risks and what are worth taking, what are not worth taking, and to help people understand that, the right questions to ask.
It's a good point. I think everything we've talked about can boil down to that, because we talked about accommodations at the outset. We could wrap it up with accommodations on the end of this, and that if whatever you choose is meeting your requirements, you still have to understand that you're introducing risk. For example, if you're going to pull a caravan, do you know how to pull a 6,000 pound thing behind your vehicle? And do you know how to use extended mirrors to turn around? Do you know that you can't go through a drive-thru at McDonald's anymore if you're pulling one? Do you know that parking spots aren't set up for those sizes? So we think about those things, really not that big a deal, because we don't need to do those things. But if you have someone tow something for the first time, can your wife tow it if you can't drive? And can you tow it? Have you ever towed? And all the things you're used to have just changed. The risk is different. The width of the vehicle is different. The visuals are different. How fast you can go, how fast you can go downhill is different. So you've taken the risk out by giving yourself a bathroom, a place that's safe from, I guess, bears. You've given yourself a bed. You've given yourself a less risky relationship with your spouse. But you now have an entirely secondary vehicle that have to be locked up. It has to be safe. It has to be checked for leaks. It has electrical. It has double axles. It has grease pack bearings. It has. So is the risk okay for the reward you get? That's always least flexible, most flexible, is what are you trading to gain safety? Mm. You know, and the balance. So that could be a very interesting conversation.
Mm. Great. Well, listen, it's been a very interesting topic, and I think, you know, there's no end to this. And I think people all have their own input from experience. And I think that's what I'm very clear on. I learn from people around the world. I learn from my clients, because everyone has a different take, and it's fascinating to see that. So great input. Thank you. I've enjoyed the connection this morning.
Thank you, Jeremy, for hosting it. Thank you, everybody, for watching. You want to wrap up, Jeremy? Thank you so much for putting this all together. Jeremy's been doing all the technical stuff, which I really need, because live shows and this kind of show to me is, I think, launching Saturn V is a little bit easier than this.
No, thank you guys for taking your time, especially in different time zones. It's amazing to be able to get together like this, that you're safe, that your families are safe, that we can still share these moments, which are very personal, and that we can share these conversations with other people. It really makes this time more bearable. So you guys taking the time for that, sharing some of the knowledge is fantastic. And we hope that you all had some enjoyment and that you'll join us again for a conversation that continues on this topic, accommodations, risk, and overlanding. So thank you very much for your time. Talk to you soon.
Yes.
Okay, so what do you reckon?
See if it works. Do you have enough to edit?
Yeah, no, it was great.
I think
it's a nice balance. I really like the balance. Jeremy, you had great input in the American experience, and I really like that, because I think it's a balanced global perspective. Yeah. And I think we've actually got a very nice balance here, because we've got an American, Australian, and African experience. You couldn't get three more polarized experiences if you tried. So actually, we should capitalize on this.
I really absolutely agree. I really do think we should capitalize on it. Now, I'm thinking about talking about the series and putting it in the title or something. But I agree with you totally. So it's Africa, Australia, US, all together. Yeah, it's good. It's very, very good.
It could be interesting. And maybe, I don't know where this fits into all the other things you're doing, Andrew, but in my mind, as we're talking, you just made a good point, Paul, as the focus changes, I can see occasionally in those focus changes, a little graphic in the bottom of the kind of outline of Africa and something saying Cape Town and Paul Marsh and something saying Perth with an outline of Australia and saying Andrew White. And then something with the U.S. and Seattle, you know, something, you know.
Great idea.
You know, it just reminds people that we are absolutely, and who knows, you can even be goofy and put a timestamp, like, because it's 7 in your time and it's 10, you know, 11 p.m. here. Yeah. You know, I think the international flavor of this could be really interesting to me.
Highlighted with exactly that. I like that outline. And even in the outline, Cape Town and then minus whatever the time is or whatever it is. I just think that's so cool. It just reinforces what we're doing now. I love the way you ended it. That was great. Everyone's safe. It's important. You know, we're all struggling to get through this time together, and let's just make it easier. So that's great. Thank you.
I like that also, because we are so global. And that's the thing that I've got to push in terms of the channel, is the fact that we're global. This is a really nice way of doing it. So thank you.
You know, Andrew, as you're talking now, you know, you're stuck in Australia and we don't know when that's going to lift, and you're going to do stuff there. I'm stuck in Africa and I don't know when that's going to lift. And Jeremy, same for you. But it doesn't mean that content doesn't blend nicely. It's still of you traveling across all the different zones to make it, which is obviously will come in time. But right now we can actually just maximize what we've got, which is great. Very good.
I think this will be very popular. I really do. I think it went nicely too. I think we'll become more used to this as well. Being the first one, I think it loosened up towards the end.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it just came a little bit more flowy towards the end. And I think once we do more of them, they will be, the anecdotal stuff is really important.
I agree.
I mean, Paul, you've got a million stories to tell. You've got so much to contribute in terms of anecdotal stuff. It's really, really valuable.
We'll do that. Yeah, we'll share that, because I think it's going to make it more interesting, and it makes it more personable when you actually admit, yeah, I did stuff up.
Yeah. So on that note, when we do these, one of the things that we can do is, it's very easy to do. If we have an image that is a good central talking point. So for example, if it was your wrecked rover, or you're talking about the reveal and we all started talking about the new color, right? If you have that image, or if you wanted me to do it, it's easy to do because we can send it. I can put that image in a stream. In fact, I can actually cut to any image on the fly by literally inserting my iPad into the stream or other things. I have lots of ways to do it. We can do picture in picture. It's all quite simple to do. But what's interesting about that is, in your editing, if you want us to interact with that image as opposed to editing it in later, we could actually have it there where we're all talking about it so that it was more natural. I don't know if that helps or not, but it's very easy to do screen share. It's very easy to do image share, that as we talk about these things, if ahead of time, Paul, you had 4 or 5 pictures that you wanted to share as we kind of used, and that was part of the theme on risk, whatever, I can pop those up through the thing and say, so Paul, your point is good. Tell me about this picture, because this is interesting. You were going through the water. What happened? And then all of a sudden the image begins to be part of the story. So we can add media, is what I'm saying, in a live deal with not a lot of work.
So Andrew, on that point, we can decide where we put that in risk. So I have a great image, and the image, I'll share it with you. It's basically an image of a vehicle on its side and stuff everywhere.
And that's your vehicle.
And that's where the bomb drops.
I remember the pic. Be good one.
Yeah. So we could, I could share those pictures with you guys, and then when we
say anything, we won't say who was driving the vehicle.
I'll explain about it
right at the end.
Talk about it.
Yeah.
Then at the end, I go, that's the risk I took, and that's such a powerful jaw dropping, like, oh my God,
yes,
really. So if I'll share those with you before we do the next one, and let's look at a point we can talk about what can go wrong in on an expedition, and then I'll drop it in, and you can. You know, that might just be something we can share from that. Love that idea. Good idea. Let's do that. It's really good.
And